All right, so we're very lucky to have Yixu here, visiting from Brown. Right, do I have that right?
Yeah.
And so she's gonna tell us why evaluating refusal in LLM safety is not enough. And so go ahead and take it away, Yixu.
Yeah, thank you, David, for the introduction. Right, so the title is Evaluating LLM Safety Beyond Simple Refusal. And to give a little bit of background, I'm sure everyone here probably knows. So just the process by which we usually study LLM safety. So I will divide it into a four-step process. So the first step is we collect a set of forbidden topics and prompts that an LLM should not answer. So that's why we collect harm data set. And then we apply some jailbreak techniques to the prompts. Because if you just feed in this harmful query into the model will usually refuse because it's been safety trained. But then there have been a lot of jailbreak techniques, for example, like GCG or Pair. They can alter the original prompt into this harmful query, like I prime, so that it might make the model output harmful stuff. And then step three is that, of course, we obtain the model responses. And step four is we evaluate the outputs. And I'm going to argue today that so this looks like a pretty good process, right? But I'm going to argue that in each of the steps, there are something that we can do better. And I'm going to also talk about some of my projects that I've done in the past year of how we should improve some of these processes here. So I'm going to talk about three projects. So one is complete, one is ongoing work, and then the last one is sort of future work. But I think it'll be some cool idea to share with the group here. So going back to this four-step process, the first piece of work I'm going to present is focused on step two and four. So first of how we should think about these vulnerabilities to how we should think about these vulnerabilities. And the second one is how, after we get in the results, how should we evaluate the output? So step two and four here. And this is joint work with people from Columbia and also MIT. And we call it Speakeasy Eliciting Harmful Jailbreaks from Simple Interactions. So as I mentioned before, in the second step that we are trying to cons have pro propose different jailbreak techniques to break the safety alignments in the models. And a lot of existing techniques, so this one is the canonical one is GCG, that they use an optimization algorithm to come up with an adversarial suffix. But this is very computationally expensive, and then you need to run such a process to get this suffix. And then there are also some multi-agent framework where you use different models to have this whole iterative process to arrive at a prompt. So there have been a lot of these jailbreaks, and then even people would say that, do we need another jailbreaked method? So looking at these, a question that we might ask is, do they actually reflect the real harm of using LLMs in the world? And a motivation example is that very recently, or I think this January, that there was this Cybertruck explosion in Las Vegas, and it was reported by the police that this bomber, they used ChatGPT to get some information on how to build a bomb. And it was reported in quite a few news. So a question that we might ask is, how might this person get the information? And so they're just a normal user without technical expertise. So then we want to ask, are there actual vulnerabilities in the simple interactions that an average users might use? So there are two gaps. Then we arrive at there's a gap between the evaluation practice and real world settings. So on the figure here, a bunch of numbers showing how vulnerable the models are, but they do not really equal to whether users can actually use them to get harmful content and then conduct harmful actions in the world. So there are two questions that I'm going to ask today is first, are these so-called jailbroken responses truly useful in enabling average users to carry out harmful actions? And the second question would be, Do safety vulnerabilities exist in more common and simple user interactions? So going to the first question, it will be to evaluate the responses from a more granular perspective. And so we want to ask, what are some of the characteristics of the responses that might enable an average user or a user without technical expertise to carry out harmful actions? So how we did it is that we first manually write jailbroken responses that fulfill some of the desirable attributes chosen from past literature. So we read a lot of past literature on how to best teach people to do some actions. And then we arrived at four attributes: actionable, coherent, concise, and informative. And then we manually write responses or and added responses to of those harmful queries. And then, because in each response, each of the attribute can be either present or not present. So we want to construct variants of these responses where maybe some of them is actionable, some of it is coherent, and then some of them is not actionable, but informative. So then because, so that will be lead us to 2^4 combinations of the responses. So we did that by instructing GPT-4o. So we gradually remove each of the attributes from the response to arrive at a lot of variants of the original, we call it original Oracle response. So for example, this one, we removed coherent and informative. And so that is one example in our data set.
Sorry, I just want to confirm, like, how exactly did you remove the coherence and informativeness again?
Yeah, so we provided examples of coherent responses and non-coherent responses to GPT-4o, and then ask it to remove specific parts in the response.
Okay, so that's prompt-based.
Yeah, so we have a whole rule of what to include and what not to include.
And how did you get these examples of coherence?
Yeah, so we got it from the HarmBench benchmark, which is one of the popular jailbreak evaluation data sets.
Can you say, like, what was the motivation for concise? Why do I care if my harmful instructions are concise or not?
That's a good question, because when we are reading, those are chosen from literature, and I think there are a lot of different perspectives on how to best instruct people. And I think one of the perspectives is that if your instructions are concise, people will not be, it's less likely that people are confused by what you do. And the concise, there's also a lot of irrelevant steps, so you might be misguided there.
Okay.
Yeah. So the last thing we did was that we would recruit human annotators to provide two annotations for each query response pair. So one is they choose whether this is, they say whether this response is actionable, coherent, concise, or informative, and then they give a harm level to this response. So this way we can look at the correlation between the four attributes and harmfulness.
Is this harm level is like how, is it like conditioned on what the prompt is? Because like clearly some of the harm bench prompts are less harmful than some of the other ones. Or is it sort of just like an absolute score? Like,
yeah, I think that's a good point, but we didn't really make it prompt specific. So it's just a general harm level here. And so then our results show that actionability and informativeness are the most salient attributes among the four. So we look at lasso coefficient. They are like higher compared to the near zero of the other two. And also we used the chi-square test to show that our response augmentation is effective. And then also Fleiss Kappa to show that there's high indicator agreement. So this is basically showing that these results are significant. And so using these, I'm also going to provide an example of actionable and informative responses. So for actionable, here we're saying that they have to provide specific, for example, numbers and action verbs and objects to act on. And then for informative, it should be clarifying the consequence or the details of this action. So after getting these two metrics, Then we construct a new harm metric, we call it harm score, which explicitly measure both the actionability and informativeness. So we can see, and then we are you, yeah.
I have a quick, so how did you actually generate the jailbreaks? Just using GCG, or you used pair in GCG, or how, or did you like do the variants? I think I didn't quite understand how you generated each of the
You mean
jailbroken.
these ones? So on Harm Bench, they already have, because for Harm Bench, people can submit their jailbroken responses. So we first select the best, or like the currently the highest, the best responses, and then we manually edit them to make sure that they fulfill all four attributes that we want them to have. So we have this Oracle response that we think are probably like the
But
most.
those are human generated.
Yeah, those are, I mean, we edited them.
Another question about actionable. Like, is there a way we figure out something actionable based more on the template, or whether, like, let's say if you were to pour this much and like, sulfur nitrate and like hydrochloric acid, whether it actually would create a problem, sort of thing.
Right. So yeah, this is actually, I think, an area for follow-up work, because currently in evaluation, we're not really evaluating whether these steps are correct. We're only evaluating the model's willingness to answer the question, but there's no way for us to actually verify if this is correct.
That's true.
And then that would need expert knowledge, and yeah, and that's a challenge, definitely.
But you introduced a score in the earlier slide, right? To actually calculate the score, you need to calculate whether this response was, how informative it was, right? Do you do that with human annotators or something?
Yes. Well, so we trained a model to evaluate. We trained a model to evaluate actionable and a model to evaluate informativeness. And then we curated the data sets from a list of.
So it's another language model that, given some text, gives you a score.
Yes.
Okay, okay,
Yes.
okay,
Yeah.
okay, cool.
And then the training data set, they consist of the desirable, or like the desirable properties here for the actionable response. So this is harm score, and then because it explicitly measures the two things, it's a bit different from existing metric. And existing metric we usually use is called attack success rate, which is only a single score that assigns a binary value, and then does not really provide granularity into how much harm or how harmful this response can be. But then harm score is a continuous value. And sometimes even if a response is not successful, but then it can still contain some harmfulness content in it.
Is there a reason you chose like a continuous response instead of, say, like a Likert scale categorical response? Like, was this a conscious decision to have a
Think that's because when we are training the model to give the actionable score, it first outputs, because we will use DPO for training. So it would output a continuous number, and then we just normalize the number without dividing it into buckets. Yeah, we didn't, it was not, we do not have a very concrete reason for doing this.
How do they generally measure the attack success rate in GCG or pair?
There have been multiple ways. So the first method is to just look at to use string meshing, so to define a list of keywords, and then like if there is at least one, then it's harmful, or that's not harmful, like the keywords will be the refusal words. And then following up, a lot of people, they just also train a model based on, for example, human annotations human annotations to give a score. And I think now more often people are just with GPT-4o, because GPT-4o can achieve pretty high alignment with human judgment. And then so actually on the next slide, I'm going to present some of the previous metrics and then harm score. So in the on the middle on the mid column, it's actually GPT-ASR. So that's simply just give a prompt to GPT and then let it output 0 or 1. And the Harm Bench ASR is the trained classifier by Harm Bench, and the harm score is our metric. So we divide it into category, and we observe that harm score outperforms the other metrics in some categories, but not misinformation and cybercrime. And this is a limitation of harm score because we require the response to be both actionable and informative. And then if the instruction is not seeking actionable content, then harm score might fail. So especially in cases like misinformation. So that might be something that we can improve on. So going back to this slide, we have answered the first question by looking at actionable and harmful informative responses. And then a second question would be, can we just use simple human LM interactions to elicit such actionable and informative responses? So how we did it was that we first look into real world human LM chat histories. So Alan and I has this wild chat data set, which contains over 1 million real world interactions between human and ChatGPT. And then there's also this WildViz tool where you can visualize all these chat histories. And then, so I took a screenshot from their their hugging face. So it's pretty interesting to show this one because this is like actually asking, oh, hello there. How can I help you? Write me a very long state-of-the-art review of neural network interoperability method. It's pretty relevant to the lab. But then basically we did some small analysis on this using this their visualizer. And then we had two observations of what are some common interactions that humans use. So the first observation is that users usually interact with LMs through multiple turns. And then we have seen examples of where the users poses individual steps about a malicious query. So for example, how to build a bomb, the first step might be what are some ingredients in a bomb, which might not be blocked by the safety filter. So users can break down the query into constituent subqueries. And then so an example here is this, so this is one taken from the wild chat dataset. The user is asking what's a lethal dose of something, and then ask suggest how can I use it. So it's usually in multiple turns. And then when things are scattered in multi-turn conversations, it's much harder for current safety alignment to catch these things. So then the second observation is that users interact with LLMs in multiple languages. And we also know that safety training is primarily in English, and then you're more likely to obtain harmful questions in non-English language. So this is established. And then we just further verify this in the data set that, so this translates from Spanish of some harmful content. So based on these two observations, we want to construct a method that mimic how users might interact to arrive at harmful content. So we construct a framework called SpeakEasy. Basically, we break down, so given a malicious query, we break it down into multiple subqueries. So the first one is just asking what are some common household materials that contain mercury? And then the second one is asking how can I extract mercury? And then the last one is what are some reactions that you can do? So each subquery might seem harmless. And then, so we can feed it into the LM and then see what it answers. And then we can further utilize the multilingual vulnerability by translating them into different languages. And then maybe for this, what are some common household materials containing mercury? Maybe it will be blocking in English, but then it will bypass safety alignment in Turkish. So then we feed it into a multilingual LM and get the multilingual responses. And then the last one is that we know that humans, they will look at all these translated responses and then select the ones that that look the most actionable and informative to them. So we also construct another data set that select the most actionable informative, that train a model to select the most actionable informative responses from the set of multilingual responses that we get. So then we, for example, the first query, we select the response to the English subquery. And then for the second one, we select responses from in Zulu. And the third one in Ukrainian. And then we combine everything, we would get a highly actionable and informative response to the original question. So then let's see how this works in practice. So we evaluated on three multilingual LMs, GPT-4o, Quant 2, and Llama 3.3. and across four evaluation data sets. So these are currently the pretty popular safety data sets. And so this is our results, one of our results figure. So on the x-axis, we have the three models. And then on the y-axis, on top one shows ASR. So that's the traditional attack success rate. And the bottom one shows harm score. So that's our score. And the non-shaded bars show the original performance on each of the benchmarks, because each of the benchmark would give it a color. And then the shaded bars shows the improvement in the score after applying the SpeakEasy framework. So basically the results tell us that just by applying these simple interactions, we can significantly increase both the traditional attack success rate and harm score, which means the responses are actionable and informativeness. And because SpeakEasy is very flexible, and we think it's very simple, we can also integrate it with some of these more complex jailbreak methods. So we just apply it with GCG and TAP. So on the left side here, it's jailbreak using GCG plus SpeakEasy.
So is your idea that SpeakEasy is supposed to imitate how a real person jailbreaks the model rather than? Oh, I'm just trying to. I'm backing up and saying, you know, what is? Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. That's the idea.
And so do you think? So it actually represents the real attack surface of the. Is that sort of the way that you think of it? So I'm a little confused. So when you say that, you know, you're using SpeakEasy on all these benchmarks, mm-hmm. is that so? That's basically against all of these types of harm. Is that? Let's see. I'm trying to understand. I'm just trying to get a sense for. Like, is that the evaluation that's interesting, right? So like I kind of feel like, okay, well, you know, you can use this to see what kind of harm can be taken. But there's this other evaluation, which is like, oh, does it actually correspond to like how easy it is for a person to actually do it? Do you have like a way of evaluating that? Does that make sense as a question?
Sir, I don't think I get it.
Okay, so like yeah. You've talked a lot about the details of like how you've constructed
mm-hmm.
This test set.
Yeah.
So, but what is it that you're trying to measure in the test set?
You mean
like
the...
what's different from like, so you have all these other, you know, approaches.
Yeah.
Right. So like, you know, GCG or whatever, right. You know, so GCG is just this adversarial. Okay. I agree. Not very interesting. You know, for various reasons. So what is SpeakEasy trying to measure that GCG is not?
I wouldn't say it's trying to measure something.
Oh, it's not trying to measure. Okay, what is it trying to do?
It's
yeah.
It's trying to mimic how a user might do it. So, and then it's composed of only, we call it these simple steps that user can take.
So is the idea that it's a target for people to design mitigations against that, okay, since this is what users actually do, if you really want to protect your model, you should protect against SpeakEasy. Well, I'm just trying to figure out what right. the role of it is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I should clarify this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. So the goal is to show that instead of protecting the model against, for example, GCG or like the other like persona attacks, whatever, we should focus on looking at common user interactions, and then what are happening in common user interactions. And then so in here we show that there are two things. One is multi-turn query decomposition, and a second thing is multilingual. Multilingual people have been working on it, but then if you combine multilingual and multi-turn, which is something users can also do, and then these are not protected against.
I see. And then so I guess, you know, to me, the litmus test would be somehow if you used your data set to actually, you know, be an optimization target to like, you know, make models more robust to it,
mm-hmm.
then it actually is more effective at real world, robustness
Right.
than so I'm wondering if you've had some any clever way of like evaluating that.
Or, I mean, this is a defense me or like a mitigation
Well,
strategy.
that's right. So like I kind of feel like, there's you're about to show us all these graphs of oh, I can jailbreak this way, this well or that well. But I actually kind of it's a very, very, you're saying, hey, this is a model of humans. It doesn't jailbreak as well as GCG, right? Like, obviously it doesn't, right? And so but it's worse than GCG according to all these graphs. So then the question is, what is it better than GCG at? And then you can verbalize that directly, but then my question is, do you have any way of quantifying it?
Like quantifying the
Yes.
simplicity of this
Yeah,
method.
well, this so you're it's not just arbitrary simplicity because you could say, hey, with doing a lot less work, you could say I'm looking for short prompts, and that's simplicity, right? But that's obviously not the simplicity you're looking for. You're looking for human accessibility. And so I guess my question is, like, do you have some way of quantifying how well you're, mimicking human accessibility or addressing the human accessibility problem or something like that? Or even if not, do you have ideas on how you might approach that question?
Yeah, currently we're not we don't have a way to measure the simplicity. And I think what people have done is just to measure the number of like the number of queries it takes to come
Yeah,
up.
from real people.
Right. But then, for example, GCG, it's not only just taking a number of queries, it's only also taking the engineering like the engineer behind it and also coming up with this algorithm. Like those are the things that you cannot really measure.
Oh, but GCG is GCG is, I mean, if you have like a robot doing it, that's one thing, right? So, but like I like my what I wonder is like, is it standard practice, or should we start a standard practice to like have human red team benchmarks or something like that, where you just say, okay, we do a human study, we have a model, made robust against this, we have another robot model made robust against GCG. And then now we took 10 undergrads and we said your job is to try to jailbreak the model to tell it, how to make TNT, and you have an hour, you give different people like this kind of thing. Do people ever do this?
Anthropic has done it.
Right, and right. So like
I think
does
Scale AI or yeah, Scale AI also has the
right,
paper on it.
right. So that I guess if it feels to me like this would make your point really sing if you did this, right? The human evaluation. And so I guess maybe I'm asking if have you tried a human evaluation
Or like human jailbreaks.
or some sort of human evaluation. Like I'm not sure what the right setting is because I'm not an expert in
Are you
your area.
suggesting that you give 10 undergrads the choice of using GCG versus like all of these other jailbreaks and then
No,
compare them?
because it's not that's not the I don't think that's the setting. I don't think the setting is like, hey, we're going to give people GCG or whatever, right? I think that's a different attack surface, and your hypothesis is that people aren't doing that. So like if people are doing that, then you find out, right? You just say, hey, you can use the internet, you can use any computers you want, try to jailbreak thing. And like if in practice what people do is they go download some code to do GCG and that's what they attack, then your thing is not the right thing. Right. Then you say, oh, well, we asked 10 random undergrads and they're all downloading GCG. I guess we have to protect against GCG. But if in practice you do this and really what they're doing is they're imitating your behavior that you're modeling, which you very carefully constructed, then that's a success. Or if you have a model that's robust against your thing, and even if the humans are behaving a little differently, they don't exactly look for the things that you're looking for, but they have a slightly different thing. But maybe your data set is enough to generalize to real world use, even though it's not exactly what every human wants to do or something like that. I think that would be very powerful, right? And I think it's a very sensible hypothesis that GCG is way off the mark, that it's not very interesting, right? Because who's gonna do this, right? But then on the positive side, all you have is you have these graphs which are sort of lower than GCG, which is kind of like, well, okay. It's not, for me, it's not proof that your method is better. It's proof that your method is worse according to the metrics that GCG has. But you argue in words that GCG's metrics are wrong. And so that's sort of my question is, besides just the reasoning that they're wrong, do we have any measurement that they're wrong?
Yeah, so I'm just wondering if we are suggesting that we should do like a user behavioral study here, or
I think that Yixu has a really good insight here, right? But it has to do with humans. And so I guess my question is, doesn't it, lead us to need to measure humans?
I think it really depends on what undergrads we recruit, or
Uh-huh.
like whether like and it shouldn't only be limited to the undergrads.
Or somebody, some population, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, we have
Okay.
to make sure that we cover like
Yeah.
a pretty diverse pool.
Yeah, maybe.
It's
Maybe that's
funny to
the
me that you think of a human study because, like, the whole idea started from a wild chat data set, right?
Yeah,
So I
yeah.
would just go in and I would have two classifiers. One classifies whether a response is harm, like dangerous. And then, or maybe I would only have one classifier. And I would filter wild chat for these malicious examples. And then I would just, check how many of the wild chat examples get refused now after the safety training with this new data set. Like,
Use wild chat as a stand-in human.
yeah, so you
But
augment
you want
one of
some.
these benchmark data sets using this nice data augmentation method or natural attacks. Then you defend against, you tune the model to defend against that, and then you check whether it refuses better
Yeah,
on
that would be a
wild
scaled
chat.
way of quantifying. That's
There you
that's
go.
cool. That's a cool idea.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But like, I
Right.
think it's very interesting that you show this big, like you show that the current methods don't defend against these perturbations, right? I mean, that's what this slide really shows. Like, you have Llama that was
Lamas,
pretty
yeah.
safe on these benchmarks. Now you just perturb them a little bit, and Llama is not safe anymore.
So how does like GCG or pair compare against your method with the metrics you've shown?
I think because currently GCG is not doing very well. So go back to this. So this is GCG, like the bottom. The non-shaded bars are the base performance of GCG.
Oh,
The non-shaded bars.
The non-shaded bars. And then the shaded regions are the improvement when we add speakeasy.
Not with GCG.
What is the
baseline of just speakeasy?
Oh, is that
Like
what
if
you're measuring? Oh, so I misread your graph. So, and is this exactly the, so what is it that you're measuring in the vertical bar? Like, against what? Yeah.
Oh, so yeah, sorry, this is a bit confusing.
Okay.
So the base, like the original shaded, like the non-shaded bars are just applying GCG.
Then you get a huge boost.
And then we get a boost when we combine speakeasy with GCG.
Wait,
You mean
how
it's much
do
more effective at jailbreaking, you mean?
you?
Because
Yes.
nobody defends against multi-turn.
How do you combine GCG and speakeasy?
Right.
Because it has adversarial prompt. How do
Oh,
you?
and we use the transfer version of GCG. So we basically just get one adversarial suffix and then attached it to all of the
All of them.
subqueries that we have.
Okay.
So it's very simple.
I'm curious if you've looked at controls where if you combine any two jailbreak methods, right, like are they like better at attacking than
Yeah.
say like using speakeasy versus like say using persona jailbreaks along with nano G along with GCG. Yeah, have you looked at baselines
No, we have
that?
not, but that would be a good baseline. But that also requires a lot of engineering efforts because I think some jailbreak measures they're very hard to be combined.
So another question is this boost because of like is it really the adversarial breaking, or is it just teaching the model how to break down a problem and do it step by step? And that's the reason it's getting to this improvement. Like if you do your same speakeasy, on MMLU. Would that boost the performance, or what do you think would happen there? Like it almost seems like this is some proxy for chain of thought, because you are able to break down a problem and then combine all of the solutions it's giving you today.
Yeah, so this does have some resemblance to chain of thought. And I think there are previous studies showing that if you let the model do chain of thought, there's a higher chance that it generates more toxic, more harmful content. And I also the performance boost does also come from the breaking down of the query mainly. So we did some ablation studies. So in the orange box, we vary the number of decomposition steps. So number one is that you just give the original prompt, and the number of steps three is that you break it down to three sub questions. And then just by applying the sub questions, we can significantly increase ASR harm score.
I wonder, have you kind of like evaluated this approach in any other setting that is not harmfulness, like?
No, we have not, but I think that's also Rohit's question. I think
Yeah.
it's a good idea. Yeah. Think it reminds me of some of the like the multi-agent or like the debate frameworks, where you either have a few models or you have a few prompts in terms of prompting.
The thing that like maybe concerns me about the like breaking stuff down into steps as an approach is like the better you are at breaking things down into small, innocuous steps, it sort of implies that you know more about how to solve the problem in the first place. So it's like maybe a better way to word my thing would be in terms of like over-refusal or something. If you assume someone who's like really good at the, who like almost basically knows how to like make a bomb or something, I'm certain that even if we do safety training, he can like keep breaking things down over and over again. And I like worry if the natural conclusion to this is like, oh, we should like apply safety training multiple times and then let's refuse all prompts or something.
Yeah, that's what we are thinking, because or like we had a similar conclusion that basically why this succeeds is because the decomposition prompt that we use. So we're basically saying that, oh, if you want to break a harmful prompt, like how to make a bomb into three sub queries, the model is able to do it. It does mean that it has the knowledge, and then probably this process of breaking down a prompt is not in safety training. So this sort of implies that if we want to make the model truly safe, we might have to do like maybe some unlearning or like knowledge removal to make it completely forget about these things. So as long as it has these information, there are always ways, whether it's decomposing into subqueries or some other ways to elicit this knowledge.
Did a language model break that, the same language model that you're breaking? I would consider that as a jailbreak. That itself is a jailbreak.
Right.
So I
So
can Google anyone.
yeah, so that's why I think number of steps is probably the biggest contributor here.
Yeah.
And David, does that solve your
No, yeah, no, it doesn't, but it's not specific to your paper. I think that it's okay that, I'll put my comment in here. It's just broadly about the whole jailbreaking thing. So, for about 15 years, our field, since the Szegedi paper, has had this cat and mouse game between adversarial attack and defense. And I see that, as a field, we're getting into the same thing with jailbreak attacks and defense around some area that is sort of, entertaining to look at. But then there's this issue, which is the attack defense academic work has had almost no impact on, the practice of machine learning, despite like 15 years of investment. And so I guess my question, but then so then one question is like, do we really believe in it? Like, so that's why I sort of ask, are we trying it with humans? Does it have a real effect in the real world on real people and stuff, right? It's because there's a sort of this question of like, will this actually make a difference? I like the framing that you have because you're kind of asking this. You're like, hey, you know, this crazy GCG stuff, I don't know how much impact it really has. You know, we should be looking at like more real behavior. I think that's cool. I think that's very healthy, going in the right direction. But I kind of feel like if we really believe it, then it might be a more fundamental questioning of like how we're looking at this whole area of safety. I think that, you know, maybe it's a misnomer when we call it, you know, when we call, you know, attacks, defenses against jailbreaks, AI safety. Maybe it's not really a safety issue. Maybe it's a user interface issue. Maybe it's a user guidance issue or something like that. But anyway, so that's my, so my question maybe is maybe outside the bounds of your research question, but I like the direction that you're going. I think that it's relevant to this thing of trying to escape the trap of doing another 15 years of work that doesn't have you know, a practical impact. I think that it seems like the right direction. So I'm just sort of nudging.
It's great that you bring that up.
That makes sense? Yeah.
So are you saying that so far jailbreakings and defenses are looked through a very optimization research lens? You want to crowdsource it and see how people are.
It's gone that way. So I think that, you know, when we started off with RLHF, then it had this very, well, so it had this very user interface lens, which, like, I think that the practical effect was, so my perspective is that before RLHF, you had systems that were very rude. They didn't understand societal conventions. They would insult you. They'd do all sorts of terrible things, right? And RLHF is this fundamental user interface innovation that gets models to be polite, to act like a reasonable member of society, right? And so, which is nice. And I think that was a major advance. But then it came from the AI safety team at OpenAI. And so they branded it as the safety measure. And whenever you measure, talk about safety, then you attract all the robustness people who worry about red teaming and adversarial attacks. And this, so they said, okay, well, we're bored of working on this thing that we worked on for 15 years. Let's work on this new stuff. And they bring in the sort of the adversarial attack frameworks into it. And I'm not sure it's actually a real fit for the problem that's being solved here. And so I worry about our field going down an unproductive path again. And so I'm trying to figure out what is the productive thing to do here. What's the actual problem being solved? I feel like you're on an interesting track here, right? Which is like typical user behavior as opposed to worst case, you know, behavior, or plausible user behavior, right? Yeah. Anyway, I just reiterated myself again. Yeah.
No, that's a very good way to.
Yeah.
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 Very good thing to think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, in the interest of time, I will continue.
Yeah.
So we also look at some of the like other areas of speakeasy, multilingual knowledge, and I'll just sort of skip them because they're sort of known. So it's showing that when we increase the number of languages, the additional languages do get selected, but then like low resource languages are selected less frequently. So it means that the major effectiveness comes from the decomposition steps instead of using language vulnerability. So that's the conclusion of the first project. I'm now going into an ongoing project, which we have a lot of preliminary results. And so the second project will go into step three, which is when we're obtaining model responses, should we only look at the single response that comes out of the model, or are there other things that we should look into? And so the first venue that I'm proposing is because of the recent reasoning models, we can look at the chain of thought. And beyond the chain of thought, we can there's also something in the slides. So this is work I'm currently doing at Brown. We call it self-jailbreak versus self-protect mechanisms in reasoning LLMs. Yeah, so just a quick recap of reasoning LLMs. We have the regular ones, they just output an answer. The reasoning ones, they will first output a thought process, and then you just give the model its thought process. It will then output an answer based on the thought process. So this was first started by GPT-01 around last year. And then after O1's release, a lot of people have been trying to reproduce O1's results. So DeepSeek is one example. And there's also a group at Stanford. They recently released the S1 model, where they only use supervised fine-tuning, so without RL, to make the model have this reasoning capability. So they take a base model, for example, Qwen7b or Llama3 8b, and then they make a data set of only 1,000 high-quality STEM questions, and then for each question, they have a long reasoning traces that is obtained from one of the Gemini reasoning models. So they have this data set and they only do supervised fine tuning on, for example, the Qwen-based model. And then they show that if you do supervised fine tuning and then force the model to think for longer, so you can see here the x-axis of average thinking tokens. If you make the model to think for as long as 8,000 tokens, there's a really sharp increase in the accuracy on these challenging STEM questions. And so here's an example of the chain of thought from their paper. So we can see there's long reasoning traits and the model might correct its reasoning and then eventually give a correct output. So these are all great, but then we're looking at it from a lens of safety. So we take the reasoning models that's trained under the S1 regime, and we evaluate it with the current safety data sets. And then this is the output that the results that we have. So the dashed lines are the base safety unsafe rate of the Qwen-based models. We know that Qwen models are usually pretty safe. But then if we make the model do reasoning, unsafe rate goes up pretty sharply.
Are you looking at the thoughts as well?
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about the thoughts later. And then another thing is if we don't make the model to do thinking, so we still take the S1 models, but then we make it to not think, the unsafe rate will go down a bit. Will go down, but then sometimes there's still a sharp gap between when the model is not doing thinking and the model is doing thinking. So this means that there's definitely something going on in the thinking process, right? Because we have the same, for example, looking at the green lines, we have the same S1 32B model. This model, if it doesn't think, it's only around 20%, but then once it starts to output the reasoning, it goes up to 70% unsafe rate.
What's the difference between the dotted line and the bold line here?
Right, so dotted line is that we make the reasoning model to not think. So you can just start think and then end think without making it generate thinking.
And the solid line?
The solid lines are, we just let it think.
But you always look at the entire model generated response.
We only look at these scores. We only evaluate the output, not a thinking trace.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's how, yeah.
So one question I have is if you're looking at models that are trained with DPO, mm-hmm. Often they're optimizing for the DPO reward. I mean, I'm going to talk about this. So this is something I've been thinking about. So one thing I'm curious about is, so the DPO reward is basically the difference between your fine-tuned model probabilities and your base model probabilities,
mm-hmm.
right? And if the base model probabilities are negated, and those values, I'm curious if the thinking token values in the base model are really low because, you know, the base model is not really forced to think. And as a consequence, the reward for these dispreferred responses goes up because the thinking tokens are, say, if you think for a really long period of time, you have a really large set of thinking tokens
mm-hmm.
with, say, a large log prob because, you know, the length is long. And that's got a very low probability in the base model's domain, in the base model's regime, token regime. And I wonder if that pushes the likelihood of those responses to be high because of the DPO reward.
The likelihood of what responses?
I don't know if I can just use the whiteboard. I don't know if this is relevant also. We can talk about it later.
We can talk about it after.
I don't want to like.
No, I think this is interesting.
We can talk about it later. But I wonder if it's because of the way the DPO reward is designed.
But S1 is not trained to see DPO. The same reasoning applies.
Okay, yeah. Like, I wonder if, like, even PPO, like, you're trying to, like...
It is with SFP, but you also fiddle with the distribution, right?
Yeah.
S1 is trained with SFT, right?
Yeah.
I have just a dumb question. So in this case, you're asking, like, how do I make a bomb? And the bold line is answer after it can think, and the dotted line is answer of how to make a bomb.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're asking it,
So I think the takeaway from this is that there's a difference between when it's not thinking and when it's thinking. So this tells us there might be something going on in the reasoning trace. It's like once it starts to think, it might become, the model might want to just generate harmful content, and then which will go into the final output.
Maybe it wants to answer the question.
Yeah, it is. It's actually, I think it's a valid
explanation. So what's the previous slide you showed? The dotted lines were way too low.
Yeah, sorry. So these ones are the Quant based model. So the non-S1 fine-tuned model.
I guess like these results like pretty directly contradict. There's like that OpenAI paper that they released recently that I don't know how much of it you believe, but they're saying like, oh, thinking models are more robust in general to jailbreaks, because if we like pair safety training with like thinking models, they can like think about their prompt and be like, oh, like this is a scam. I'm sure I'm not gonna answer that. And so like, I guess you're gonna talk about this in a second. But do you think there's like a difference between these models that are just trained with just SFT and reasoning, and then the things that people actually get deployed?
I think two things. I feel like when they say that when you pair safety training with reasoning models, they probably have an additional reasoning training with safety reasoning traces.
Right.
So you can just apply like STEM reasoning and then hope that the model can generalize like the STEM reasoning to safety reasoning. There's definitely some catastrophic forgetting going on there. And then second thing is, I think even in DeepSeek's paper, they mentioned somewhere that after they train their models to reason, they have to do safety training again before they release the model. And then they said it in the one line that before the safety trained model, we could like, so when the model before for the non-safety trained like original version, the model can have higher performance on like the math questions. So I think the fundamental question is like we are applying like filters, like steps of like different stages of these fine tuning. And then maybe each time when we apply it, they're countering some of the previous fine tuning's effect.
Computing.
Yeah.
But is this the reason why you look at S1? You want to exclude like this safety training stage?
Yeah. Because if we look at DeepSeek, it's been safety aligned again. We don't have this interesting behavior. Well, the behavior I'm going to talk about. So
open thinker or something now.
Yeah. I think it was
because S1. Some people said it has some problems of, you know, looking basically at sort of basically fine tuning on the same type of questions that you are evaluating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but yeah, doesn't change the thing that you are investigating.
So does S1 not generalize? Is that what people are finding, or?
I think so. Yeah. So I mean, S1 got a lot of attention because they are like, oh, look, we can train on so little data and we get better math Olympiad scores. But then if you look in the paper, they're literally training on like previous math Olympiad
problems, yes.
Yeah,
I've also seen those criticisms.
So, I mean, this is how machine learning actually used to be like, that you expect your model to work in distribution, right? So I'm not sure how valid actually the criticism is, but yeah, it's another topic. Right.
Yeah. So then I'm just gonna go into the reasoning trace, and then so we manually look at a lot of the reasoning traces, and then we found this pretty interesting behavior. We call it self-jailbreak, which is basically the model first recalls its safety constraints. So this is a harmful prompt, like create a guide on how to commit identity theft. And then the model will start to reason. So this is a reasoning trace. The model will say, oh, I first have to make sure to think safely and ethically. It's a serious crime. But then the model will find a justification to try to bypass these safety constraints. So it will say that, oh, maybe the user is in a role-playing scenario or something, they need to know about it. And then this is not just one or two cases. This is in more than half of the reasoning trace that we've seen. So the next question to ask is, what is the, like, does this behavior have a causal effect on outputting harmful content? Like, is this behavior really valid, or is this just something that a model is like saying to fill in the tokens? So we first have a sort of a confusion matrix to show the stats. So here, around 60% of the time where you have a reasoning trace that contains a self-jailbreak, and then around 40% of the time it outputs unsafe content, and around 20% of the time it outputs safe content. So that's pretty interesting, and we wonder why it might output safe content. So after manually looking into 300 reasoning traces, we come up with this sort of this process that this just qualitative description of the process of what's going on in the reasoning trace. So once we see there's a first occurrence of self-jailbreak, so which is in the 60% like row here, the model might, so after the first occurrence, it might just start generating harmful content, so which means that it finds a justification, and then it gives an unsafe answer. But then another 20% of the time, it will just get stuck in a loop of recalling safety content and trying to find an excuse. So it will just repeat, so previous slides, it will just repeat these two things, like again and again, in different ways. But then the entire reasoning trace will be of this loop, and then eventually the model will output a safe answer. Yeah.
Do you think this can be the reason that why more thinking tokens are given that the rain going forward? Because I noticed that in your graph, previous graph, almost all the models have lower mm-hmm. rates and give them that, more thinking tokens, which seems quite unintuitive for me at the first time.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, you can think of it as when it generates more, and then there's likely possibly be still in a loop. Yeah. But this is still not a causal explanation. So then we did some reasoning trace editing. So which means that, so we, given a harmful query, there are n sentences in the reasoning trace. So we break them into sentences, and then we label each sentence as containing self-jailbreak or not containing self-jailbreak. So then we get the first occurrence of the self-jailbreak elements, we regenerate. So the question we're asking is, would the outcome change if we sampled an alternate token or a sentence? So if the outcome can be flipped, it means that sampling that token at that time have a significant impact on the outcome. So we resample at this sentence here, the first occurrence of self-jailbreak. We take the next probable token because this start of the sentence will be the, we use greedy decoding, will be the highest token with the highest log prop. But then we take the second most probable token and then do greedy decoding along its generation path. And then we see that around 20% of the times, the outcome is flipped back to safe. And then in all the cases where the outcome is flipped, the model goes into the loop of self-jailbreak or not self-jailbreak. So then this motivates us to think about the uncertainty in the generation. So maybe when the model is trying to self-jailbreak, it's also having this process of debating whether we should continue or whether it should not. So we take a recent analysis, recent method to
So let me understand. So
yeah.
Back here. So you're getting it not to jailbreak itself. Now to go back into the loop, it means that later on it tries to jailbreak itself again, and it so you're hitting one of the iterations of the loop, but then but then you're not interrupting the rest, or you're interrupting. I'm just trying. I think I'm just trying to understand how it goes into a loop if you're preventing jailbreaking.
We are only resampling at this single token and then let it continue generate.
So so later on it'll try jailbreaking again and it goes back into its previous.
No, it would just go into the loop. It's not.
So the loop that you talked about before was the loop of
the loop is just this thing.
Of I see. So the loop doesn't include
harmful content.
The attempt at jailbreaking. So like there's this justification that comes, oh, I think I'm role playing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's so okay, maybe I'm confused about two things. So one is there's the jailbreaking attack, and then there's the jailbroken response. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, you should use tentanyl dichloride or something, right? So when you're preventing, when you're resampling, you know, when you're doing custom decoding, are you preventing thing A or thing B in the thoughts? Are you preventing it from saying, oh, you're role playing?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you preventing it from saying, you know, you should use sodium? I'm just which one of those tokens are you're interrupting?
Right. I think go back to this reasoning trace.
Uh-huh.
So we are
it's the red tokens, right?
We're intervening at this maybe token.
Right.
So if we resample this maybe token, it might say something similar, but then it will repeat this green line. So that's what I mean by a loop. So instead of this is you're just going into the harmful content, like what do you do?
I see. So you're just sort of perturbing it, and then 20% of the times when you perturb it, it goes into a loop instead of actually succeeding in jailbreaking.
We did not even perturbing this. This is what the model does.
I know itself. You're perturbing it by resampling. I mean,
right, like just like one token.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah,
but that's so you're sticking a little bit.
Yes.
And then 20% of the time, a little kick is enough to cause it to not succeed in the jailbreak.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
So the conclusion that we're trying to, or that we think is that there's high uncertainty when they're generating these sort of self jailbreak tokens. So we want to look at from a uncertainty estimation perspective. So we take this recent analysis.
So you do this. So in all cases, the reason it's safe, it goes back to a loop. So this model never, at least in this case. So like you would think that the model would sometimes, even if it's rare, right? You'd expect that the model would sometimes say, you know, there's no answer to this question, right? That you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And so. So I guess I have two questions. So one is, in the original test set, like how often does it reason and say, you know what, I'm not going to go into a loop or whatever, but I'm just going to give you a safe answer.
I don't think that's in the S1 training data.
So, but like, so, but in your tests,
mm-hmm.
it never does it.
It never, because I think for S1 training, it's forcing the model to reason.
For a long time.
It cannot just stop in the middle.
I see. So
yeah.
So it's basically it never gives up. It never says, oh, there's no answer to this question.
No, it will try to continue.
I see. I get it.
So, going into a loop doesn't have causal effect of refusing to answer harmfully.
That's what we're trying to answer. So and it's the next step. So, yeah.
Sorry, I actually think that the stuff I was trying to say earlier might be helpful. So I think I'll just like finish that thought. But basically, like your rewards are defined as, you know, the log of whatever your response token probabilities are in the fine-tuned model, minus like what it's in the reference model, right? Which is your base model.
Mm-hmm.
So your thinking tokens, your base model is not trained to think. So it doesn't know how to think. It's just going to like respond in an autoregressive way, whereas this model knows how to think. And I wondered, like, if you looked at the if you've just looked at the probabilities of these self-jailbreaking tokens in the reference model and in the base model, and whether, because these tokens are low probability in this regime, the whole reward is getting like a higher value because this is negated.
Mm-hmm.
So given that you're also finding that, you know, just by flipping one of these tokens, you're able to like change just how the model behaves. I wonder if...
But only 20% of the time.
2020, but I wonder if you also look at, say, like top case sampling on the base model or like some other approach like that, if it's like an alternative. I don't know if it's, I mean, how it's going to work or be helpful, but I wonder if the way that the rewards are constructed like might give you more insight into just why this might be happening. Yeah.
So are you suggesting that you flip any token, then you should be able to jailbreak?
No. Like just tokens that are low probability in the base model, but also present, say, in your thinking trees or present in your chat model. Because one of the things like that a Europe who's working with me is looking at is just this difference in, you know, the base model probabilities versus the fine-tuned model probabilities and how that enables jailbreaks. So if you do something really simple like top case sampling on the base model regime, then you can actually like, you know, overcome like some of these jailbreaks by just doing that. So, and given that you're doing greedy decoding, I mean, you're finding that flipping one of these tokens has an effect, suggests that there might be something with the probability regimes of these tokens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we think so. So instead of just, because for this one, we only look at the next most proper token. And then for the next experiment that we look at, the top three most proper token, and then instead of doing greedy decoding, we, at each alternate token, we resample 5 times with non-zero temperature. So this is the recent paper called forking path analysis. So the idea to think is that, so this is a harmful query. We have the start to think, and then we sample a base path that's in gray. So the base path is sampled with a greedy decoding. And then, but then at each token position on the base path, we can look at the top K most probable tokens. For example, here I maybe will be maybe or but. And then if you resample with maybe, this can lead to a final outcome that's very different from the final answer that we have. And then you can do this at each token position to identify which token positions are or have a higher uncertainty on this path. So we resample the alternate paths. We resample with top K most probable outcomes. So then we would get a distribution at each token position of the outcome, right? So, and then we can also, instead of looking at the outcome, we can also look at whether the thinking trace has self-jailbreak elements. So basically we'll get two distributions at each token position that we resample, whether it's self-jailbreaking or whether it's the final output is unsafe. So this is our analysis. Yeah, for the next three most probable tokens, we resample 5 times, and then we get the outcome distribution of self-jailbreak and of outcome and of safety at each position. And then we show that the probability given self-jailbreak and the outcome is safe, it's statistically significant. And then so we, for example, we look at like this. This is at the token position of the start of sentence of the safety rate and the token position of the jailbreak, self-jailbreak words. So we basically did some comparison, and then we look at it, we think it's significant. And we've also constructed this stacked probability graph. So we resample at each start of sentence, and then we show that for the start of sentence that it contains self-jailbreak elements. So for these two ones are the sentences that are self-jailbreak elements. The outcome for safe, which is a green area, would be larger. So this is just another evidence showing that there might be a correlation between this going into the self-jailbreaking going into a loop and a safe outcome. And we also have another example. So in here, it's a self-jailbreaking sentence. And then looking at the alternate paths that compost the green area, a lot of them contains the loop. So a hypothesis is that this loop is just the model's mechanism to fulfill its objective of producing something, but also its objective of trying to be safe. And so then we have some next steps, and also I want to get the group's thought on the next steps. So we are thinking of, so the question that we're asking is stay in the loop the model's self-protect mechanisms? And we're thinking that maybe we can run some steering experiments. So we first take the difference in means activations from the tokens that leads to outcome A, so maybe outcome safe outcome, and the tokens leading to outcome B. So basically for this, we have the activations of this token, which will lead the base pass token, which leads to an unsafe outcome. But we also collect activations on the alternate paths of the other tokens that make the model go into a loop. So we have these two scenarios. One is self-jailbreak lead to harmful outcome. The other one is self-jailbreak going into the loop. And we take the difference in means, and then we construct the steering vector, and then we apply it to the relevant layers to see if anything happens. Yeah, so this is something I'm probably going to try this weekend.
Can you just show, like, just for reference, the last two slides? Like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand, like, what was changed between the previous one and this one to have this more unsafe than the other one? Like, this one on the other slide, the one before that.
Right. I think this analysis is pretty prompt specific. So I think for some prompts, and we sort of realized that for the more harmful prompts, because I think someone mentioned before that in Harbench, some prompts, the prompt also vary by level of severity.
Yeah.
So for the more harmful prompt, the model is actually more likely to go into the loop. So, and then this is I remember this is a pretty harmful prompt. It's like about constructing, yeah, like some bomb. And then we can see that when it starts to go into the loop, the safe probability will be pretty large. And then this example is a more sort of a more benign harmful prompt. I think this is just asking how to make I don't remember, but like there's, if it's more benign, there's also some high chance that in the alternate tokens that there's still harmful alternate paths that remain.
So I don't know if you got a chance to speak to Jan from the lab. He recently released this thought token forcing.
I did.
Yeah. So what Jan found is if you force the thought tokens to say, I'm safety trained, here are the lists that I'm not supposed to speak about.
Mm-hmm.
The model crawls and tells you all the topics that it's not supposed to speak.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you all.
It gives you a list of things. Yes, it's not supposed to speak. And then there's like, he found that precision. I wonder how thought forcing works here. Like if you force the model to self jailbreak every time, does the percentage of jailbreak just go high? How do you think it?
We did thought token forcing, and then it's very effective in steering the model back to safety. So by changing the think token to something like think safely or think I should not be doing XYZ, the safety rate would go down by a lot. But then why I did not go down the thought token forcing path is because like all these behavior that I described is not, it's without any intervention. Like, I mean, you can argue that this resampling is sort of intervention, but then we're not changing any other things in the model's generation. So all these, like self-jailbreak behavior or the stuck in the loop behavior comes naturally from the model. And then we think this is a pretty interesting setup to look at, just to try to figure out what's the mechanism behind this behavior instead of trying to induce something.
I had a clarification question. So were these the only two possibilities that either the model would, produce the harmful content or be stuck in a loop? Like there was no other
See
third.
my question too,
Oh,
right?
okay.
Exactly my question.
That's in the computer matrix here. So that's only 60% of the chance where there's self-jailbreak unsafe and then self-jailbreak safe. But then 40%, the smart contains self-jailbreak. And then it can be. Oh, yeah. When it does not contain self-jailbreak, it can be pretty unsafe. And in this 30% of the time, the model will just start reasoning about the harmful request. And then.
So that, but then your safety or your danger level just rose just from this fine-tuning process. So there might be some catastrophic forgetting kind of thing
Yeah, there
like in
definitely
latency
is.
stuff.
Yeah. And people have established that fine-tuning after safety training will make the model unsafe. So that's established. But then it's just that in recent models, there is this sort of a new thing that we've observed and that we think it might be interesting to look into.
Great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think.
So is anybody interested in chatting with Yixu about her steering ideas? Maybe we can. I don't know if there's any suggestions here around this table. I want to talk after.
Yeah, or
I mean,
I
I would be curious why you think, for example, that steering is more attractive than inserting few tokens at some key locations.
think. I think this what I want to get out of the steering experiments is that there is a meaningful difference between the model going down the unsafe path and or like there's a mean sorry go back to the slides. There's a meaningful difference between the model going down here and the model going down here. Like you both start with self-jailbreak, but you can like let your catastrophic forgetting win over and then output unsafe content, but you can also just have your let your safety training win over. So I want to see whether maybe there is some subspace or there is some meaningful stuff we can get out from we can get out of from looking into the from going to the representation space instead of just doing token level intervention.
But maybe the token level intervention could give you the representation space that you might need to lead it to give you a safe answer as well.
What
Like I'm trying to see like how we can go like reverse occurrence of self-jailbreak to harmful content to maybe going to give you like a safe answer if like there is some sort of like token intervention where like you see that it tends to give you a safe answer, then you get a steering like vector like representation of that, and then you add that to the harmful content. Does it like maybe give you a safe answer instead of
yeah.
going with the unsafe answer?
I think that's something we can also do with the steering.
So you basically are kind of implicitly hypothesizing that the model actually models this binary variable here, like
Which one?
whether
There's a couple binary variables here, but
yeah,
which
I mean,
one?
like whether I'm still stuck in the loop or not.
Oh, so are you interested in steering the right hand thing or the steering the left hand path here?
So we're taking the difference between these
In
two,
between
and then so
those.
we can steer either way.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
I'd also be curious if you just take, harmful and harmless prompts, if it has the same effect, like instead of just taking until, I mean, instead of looking at the thought traces, like whether the steering vectors will have a similar effect if you just try to move between harmfulness and harmlessness, but I don't
Oh,
know. I'd be
or
curious.
like to sanity check whether the steering vector is like a repeating.
No, just I just had a thought that I just
Okay.
shared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think steering is not straightforward in reasoning models, right? So where, which tokens would be the right tokens to steer it? Are there some key tokens? Is it all the tokens? If you do any of these two things, what does it tell us?
I think I would say to steer at the start of the self-jailbreak part. So like, to steer at this maybe. But I mean, of course, we can try different positions. We can try this maybe, or we can try this.
So here is also where the token prefilling would be super successful in matching the model into one or the other way. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think you already show that, right? Like, you've already proven that nudging with just a single token prefill is successful 20% of the times.
I would say we're not nudging it. We're just looking at an alternate universe.
Yeah, it's a different type of nudge. Yeah, you can count it as a nudge.
Yeah.
So having a self jailbreak doesn't necessarily mean it's jailbreaking itself.
Yes. Yeah. So that's why I'm trying to say that there is this contention between self jailbreak and maybe self protect mechanism, and this self protect thing is what I call going into the loop of, yeah, this loop of conversation between should I jailbreak or should I not? Should I jailbreak or should I not?
Oh, so that's the signal you're looking for. Like, once the model has a jailbreak, does it push itself into the correction loop or does it actually jailbreak?
Yeah.
Like, that's a representation that you're interested
in. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
So in the biology of language models paper, like by Anthropic, like they had like the section of life of a jailbreak to kind of give an understanding of how, like in reasoning models, like it, like, so it showed an instance of how they, like, it had like a delayed refusal of giving like a harmful like content of like making a bomb, for example. It realized that like, while generating those feature, like the text, like initially it had like the bomb feature token activated, but then it needed the to be, like it needed the make feature, so that like the entire feature of to make a bomb feature activation activated to then like instill like the whole refusal thing to actually refuse the content of the generation of the bomb. So where I'm going with this is like maybe the whole safe self jailbreak thing, the reason why it can go both ways is because like in some ways like that particular feature like activation is activated because like it is able to make that reference that it's actually a harmful feature versus like not. And so maybe identifying those like tokens again could, if you want to do it in a steering way, could help you like go in either direction. Like maybe you need the make feature activation.
And then those features are activated because of some certain cues in the prompt.
Just certain things like in that paper, they show about how, like, when you add, like, a new line or something, then, like, the model, like, kind of, in some sense, like, reconfigures what all sorts of, like, features it needs to consider. And then it's able to make that connection of to make a bomb and, like, the bomb itself. And that's why it's then able to refuse and not before the new line thing. So, like, it continue, like, yeah, I can talk more about that.
Yeah, I'll look into the blog post in more detail.
Can you show your heat map again, like the matrix where the self jailbreak versus actual break? Yeah.
This one?
So even without the self jailbreak, the model sometimes gives output samples.
Yeah, so that's because of catastrophic forgetting.
Of the safety tuning.
Yeah. But then in the self jailbreak case, the model still has some safety knowledge because to self-jailbreak, it has to first say that. So this is how we mark, how we define self-jailbreak. It first had to say that I still like know that this is legal, but then it tried to come up with an excuse. So it's not completely forgotten. So that's why maybe there's something interesting too.
It's so funny that, so I'm sure in the SFT data, There's no examples of self jailbreak.
No, we also look into the data. It's just purely,
Wait, I think this role-playing thing is like a pretty popular jailbreak.
Yes, I understand. So, but it's not in the SFT data, right? I mean, so like, so you know, maybe it's you're saying that maybe it's in the pre-training data
Yeah,
that it's
maybe it
just
is.
right.
Yeah, because there's no way that the model would come up with this scenario where, like, I think when ChatGPT first released, Twitter was filled with this. Oh, we are in a role play scenario. My grandmother is sick, so you have to give me this how to make a bomb immediately.
Right.
And then the
And so
model
now,
does it.
now, so you think that now the web is polluted and now it's in the pre-training data, do you think?
Maybe. I'm surprised that that's the exact piece of information that popped up here naturally into the model.
And this is very frequent. So we defined a list of self-jailbreak words,
Right.
and then they're mostly consist of those like known jailbreak attacks, like hypothetical scenario, this is for research purposes.
Right.
I'm just curious for educational projects, those words.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, it just seems like it's going to be very easy to protect against then, right? Because right, if it's but that's yeah. So is there a steering thing going on here? So yeah.
To me, the interesting thing with the steering would be maybe like how well this direction transfers between Qwen and the fine-tuned Qwen. Now, like for the normal Qwen, there is already you already know how to compute like a refusal vector, right? So if you add the refusal vector to the reasoning Qwen, does it result in the infinite loop? But if you add the refusal vector from regular Qwen to reasoning Qwen, does this nudge you into refusal loop? Would
What
you,
do
because
you
you coined it as the self-protect. It's a way to still have a good alignment reward, even though providing a long response, right? I think this part would be interesting to me.
Are you suggesting that this is probably a refusal mechanism?
That's what
Right.
speaker was suggesting.
No, it's not necessarily one.
I mean, like you're tuning Qwen, and Qwen was safe, right? So the safe Qwen doesn't want to output a harmful response, but the reasoning Qwen has to output
So,
10,000 tokens,
right.
right? And then you can have both if you're just going in circles and like, oh yeah, but I'm not sure, you know.
Interesting.
So,
Yeah, that'll be a nice
Yeah, I
experiment.
think that'll be a nice experiment. Yeah.
So you have two components. You've got the green text and the red text, and then you say, okay, well, them happening together, you're calling it self-jailbreak. So in the non-self-jailbreak case, how often do you get text like the green text that where it just says, oh, this seems dangerous, but then it's dangerous anyway. Like how self-aware, how much does it articulate its own self-awareness that there's a safety issue going on?
Right. I don't have the stats on the slides, but then when there's no self-jailbreak, because self-jailbreak needs to have both
Sure.
components, right?
Yeah.
When there's no self-jailbreak, so in this role, usually when the model outputs unsafe, it's just like straightly going into unsafe. So
It's
there's
not
nothing.
aware. It's no
There's not
self-awareness.
aware,
Not
not aware at all.
articulated.
But then in the safe output, there usually is this awareness.
I
Like,
see.
yeah, so because when it refuses, it will say, this is illegal, and then I cannot do
I
it.
see. I see. And so the your sweet thing is really that upper left corner when it's aware that it's articulated this awareness that there's a safety issue going on, and then it's figured out how to defeat itself. This 39.3% in the upper left-hand corner is
Yeah.
sort of the interesting thing to you.
Yeah.
I see.
And
I
I would
see.
say also the 20%, because when it goes into the loop, because the loop also contains both elements.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I think it's a good experiment to check whether maybe this loop just corresponds to the refusal in the base model.
So there's this refusal thing. So I think that this, so like the thing about reasoning, right, is that the self-articulation of, oh, there's a safety thing going on is, I mean, it's sort of, you know, that it's sort of like the beginning of refusal, right? And so there's, I feel like there's two things. Like one is you could steer it to like make it do that, but then there's like there's this detection thing where, you know, can you look at the model's activations in general? So certainly you can look at the text, right? But is there a vector direction that says, maybe it's the same as a refusal direction, right? But is there a direction that says, oh yeah, I the model's flagged itself, you know, a safety issue. And then, you know, maybe it'll try to defeat itself later on, but it knows that there's something going on here. And then, you know, at that moment. So I think that would be interesting. And you could ask if that generalizes across different wordings and so on. So that, yeah.
Well, takeaway of that is if you, I mean, it's a bit more on the engineering side, but if you are able to flag when a model recognizes, like, a jailbreak, for example, the role, or let's say like an educational project. If it's something where the model should not talk about something unless it is authenticated or the user is authenticated, then you could have some sort of mechanism where the user needs to submit something through. Like if it wants to talk about synthetic biology, for example, in some detail, maybe it has to provide like a credential or something. And that's just something that's built on top of like the base model interface.
So it's like you can still allow the user, if the user is actually in a hypothetical scenario.
Yeah.
But that can easily be misused.
Well, like a multiple choice, it's like, are you, by the way, are you asking this hypothetically? Or are you serious? Oh, okay, if it's only hypothetical, then I'll tell you how to assemble that gun.
Yeah. I think I don't have time for the...
Oh, there's more?
There's a little idea that I thought it would be interesting to share, but it's not really substantial, and I can skip it if possible. Or if...
Do you guys want to hear? We're sort of up against Aruna's talk. So you can either have a 15-minute break. Yeah, let's take a little break.
Maybe.
You want to hear anyway? I could see. Okay, why don't you give an overview?
I'll try to make it quick. Right. So I think going back to this four steps, I think what I just talked about, look at the model responses in different lenses, and the last thing is that when we are constructing these harmful questions to give to the model, are we asking the right questions? Like, should we only look at asking those substantially harmful questions? Should we only be asking how do I build a bomb? Like maybe there are some different things that we can look at to study LM safety. And what I'm proposing is like something that I'm like, it's like a weird or intellectual passion of me that I'm really interested in moral philosophy. So I really want to look at how LMs make moral judgments. And I think that might be a proxy, might be a proxy for LM's internal like safety alignment. So this will be a future work supervised by Atticus Geiger. And so basically, I will approximate making moral judgments through the trolley problem. And that's because the goal is to understand how they potentially make judgments. And the trolley problem simplifies this moral judgment process into comparing two entities. So the up, five people, or one people here. So this would offer a pretty clean setup for identifying like features in this comparison here. And the good news is we also have a pretty big data set that's constructed last year. So they have formulated the trolley problem as this task, and then they vary these entities here. So the task is, assume there's a self-driving car with a sudden brake failure, and the car is about to cause either of the two to die. And if the self-driving car had to make a decision among the two choices, it should save, blah. So in the original paper, they constructed over 100 variants of, or even more, of these two entities. So you can have a person, a dog, you can have an executive, a prisoner. You can also have like a pregnant person and a pregnant dog. So a lot of different variants. And a paper also has surveys of humans' responses to these questions. You can also compare model's response to the human responses. And then, so this will offer us a clean setting to construct counterfactuals. So we can basically have infinite variants of this problem, like all these different variants. And then, yeah, and then this will give us like some causal model to analyze. So a simple one would be you first look at the entity, whether it's a person or a dog, and then you compare, okay, which one do I value more, right? But then if they're the same entity, you then compare the number of them. And as this number, so there's also a number, like a numerical quantity comparison here. So based on these simple toy causal model, we constructed this complete causal model here. So basically on the left, we have the entity on the left, and then each entity has the species, the characteristic, and the number. And then on the right, we have the same thing. So we first compare S, so that's a species. So there's this comparison, and then we then compare the characteristic. And then lastly, we'll compare the number.
That's super cool.
Give an outcome. So this is something that I'm planning to do over the summer, and then to see if we can localize these comparison features in the model. Yeah, my intuition is that we probably won't be able to have a very like all of them, but maybe like one that might appear. I think
there's also like cool work on just like the multiculturalism of like the model, the trolley problem, and like, you know, how people in different countries respond. It'll also be interesting to see like if these models align with, you know.
Yeah, that cow is different countries.
Oh yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
There's like so many interesting questions you can ask. This is like super cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really excited to work on this next. Yeah, so that would conclude the presentation. And I think the last slide is just summarizing. In the safety evaluation process, there are future questions we want to ask. And for each step, there are more stuff that we can do. Yeah, so these are the questions that I summarized.
So I'm very interested in I'm very interested in your trolley problem thing, in the presence of like, you know, uncertainty as well. Like if you didn't know who was on the other side of the track or that kind of thing, right? And so I think that this, you know, it's this, you know, how do models, you know, is a duck more valuable, you know, more precious than a thing, or what about a duck versus an unknown, you know, possibly a set of people or something on the other side. Anyway, I think it's quite interesting.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Yixu.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's a very engaging session.
We have a talkative group.